929-205-6099. Enter this meeting ID number 922-457-2995. And as if that isn't enough, we also have a password. The password is 995-995-99. Do you have to contribute to BAI to access the meeting? No, but it sure would be nice if you would do that.
Thank you, Dee Dee. It is 9 p.m. You are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI in New York City, 99.5 FM on the dial, and streaming at WBAI.org. It is time now for Backstage Stories with Marcia Pendleton.
I said I like it like that.
I said I like it like that.
And welcome to Backstage Stories on listener-supported WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming at WBAI.org. I'm Marcia Pendleton, the producer and your host, and we just heard Golden by Jill Scott, a.k.a. Jilly from Philly. Tonight, we are celebrating our show's second anniversary, and there's a lot to celebrate today. Brittany Griner was released today, the Respect for Marriage Act was passed, and Herschel Walker is not a United States Senator. In addition to all that good news, you'll hear from two amazing artists this evening, Kevin Powell and Jacinto Taras Riddick. We are celebrating their new projects, a new publication from Kevin, and the New York premiere of a film by Jacinto. First up is our conversation with Kevin Powell. Let's listen. Recording. I am a writer and have been since I was a kid, but my mom has a grade school education. My grandmother, her ma, could not read or write, and I only learned recently my late father could not read or write either. I write for them. I write for me. I write for anyone who feels their voice does not matter. It does. It does. It does. These are words from a person who is an activist, poet, journalist, and the author of 15 books, including the one we are going to talk about right now. His name is Kevin Powell, and the book is Grocery Shopping with My Mother. And welcome to Backstage Stories to my friend, Kevin Powell.
Thank you. It's my honor. You know, just thank you so much. I can call you MP. That's my new name. MP.
Okay.
No, I just, I'm really happy to have this opportunity. Thank you so much.
So let's start from the very beginning. When did your love affair with words, with the written word, begin?
My mother, definitely. My mother's from South Carolina. They are from the low country of South Carolina, down by Savannah. So they are proud Geechee folks, you know, as we say. And she's a storyteller. And I would hear all these incredible stories about our ancestors, our relatives, and also our living relatives and our ancestors of South Carolina. And it was mind-blowing. I didn't realize the impact. I was hearing these stories from age 2 or 3 years old. And it just stuck with me. And, you know, we would make trips to South Carolina periodically. And, you know, I would take all of that in, and just the difference in the culture from being in the North versus the South, as you well know, Marcia. And I didn't know that, you know, the way my mother spoke, the way she prepared food, the way she organized a home, all of it had an impression on me on how to arrange ideas. And I actually drew. I don't know if you knew this. I drew first as a child. I love visual arts. To this day, I really love visual arts. You can even see, you know, my house looks like a museum. You know, there's colors everywhere. But I drew. The thing that I'll say, that I didn't know that Black people were visual artists, and I didn't know that Black people were writers for a very long time, because I'm in the first generation of folks who went to integrated schools. And that's important to say. You know, my mother, like a lot of folks coming out of the civil rights era, you know, fought for me to be in the best, so-called best public schools. But it meant that I didn't get any Black history, any Black culture. And so I knew I wanted to write when I started going to the library with my mother. Again, at age 8, she took me to the library. I started with what I love, and I was a sports fan early on. I'm still a massive sports fan, so I read a lot of sports books for 3 years, back and forth to the library. My mother read the newspaper, so I was always reading, and that was stressed to me. And you know, as I say in the post that I made today, you know, about the book that I made about the book, you know, my mother has a grade school education. My grandmother, her mother could not read or write, you know, but what they had, which many of our people have, is the gift of telling a story. And so I just fell in love with stories in different forms. And then when I was 11, I discovered Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls. And that's when I really said, okay, you know, I read the book, and this is way before Androids and cell phone, iPhones and all the stuff we have now at our fingertips. Literally, I went to the library. I looked up an encyclopedia. I don't even know if folks remember what encyclopedia is at this point.
Oh, I did. I do. We had, you know, the World Book and the encyclopedia.
Yes.
Absolutely.
It was exciting. And I remember saying to myself, I understood as much as I could of For Whom the Bell Tolls, as much of who Hemingway was. I said, well, if this is what a writer does, then I want to be a writer. But I did not. I was 11 years old. It would still be another 7 years. And when I got to college, Rutgers University, New Jersey, where I'm from, that I actually found out that Black people were artists, that Black people wrote. I didn't know. I mean, I didn't get Lorraine Hansberry growing up. I didn't get Langston Hughes, Zora Neale Hurston. I didn't get Sonia Sanchez. I didn't get Mary Baraka. I didn't get the Black Arts Food. I didn't get the Harlem Renaissance. Mm-hmm. I didn't get any of that stuff. And so I got Shakespeare, who I loved. I got Edgar Allan Poe, who I loved. You know, I got all of that. I was getting a lot of Charles Dickens and that kind of stuff. But, you know, it on a basic level, it gave me an excitement about writing. But it was a Black woman named Lillian Williams, Mrs. Williams, rest in peace, my 12th grade English teacher in at Snyder High School in Jersey City, who saw something in something that I wrote. And she made me enter an essay contest, and I won a citywide essay contest. And that's when it really dawned on me. But even when I graduated from high school, my yearbook said, I want to be an accountant because I was good at math, and I still didn't know. I didn't even know what an artist was. And it's funny because I'm of the generation that, you know, rest in peace, Irene Cara, you know, I saw Fame and all of that, but I was like, those are kids who they can sing and they can dance and they can act. I can't do any of those things. I didn't know that being a writer also was being an artist. But when I got to college, that's where it crystallized for me. That's when I realized, okay, I can do this. I can, because I started seeing these stories about Langston and Zora, and especially, I need to say this, reading Langston Hughes's poetry and reading Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes and Watching God, and realizing that she was using the language of the people of her community in Florida. And I was like, this is just like the way my mother and my family speaks in South Carolina. So it was also the first time, Marcia, that I realized that the way Black people speak is art. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. I did not know all of that about you. But when you spoke about being 11 years old and making those kinds of discoveries, I remember when I was 12 years old, I was at a junior high school in Philadelphia that I had a teacher by the name of Mr. Partee. I will never forget his name, that he introduced me to my first course in, it was called Afro-American History.
Yeah.
And that was when I learned that we were more than what the media images that I was seeing at the time, you know, like late 60s, early 70s, I had no idea that there were kingdoms in Africa. I had no idea. And that's when I was introduced to the work of Langston Hughes.
Yes.
You know, and the idea of Black people being artists, you know.
That's right.
So education is so important, and it opens up a whole world for us. And I said this last week, that's why the folks who enslaved us stopped us from reading. That's why reading was illegal. Learning how to read and write was illegal, because it opens up whole new worlds for us and empowers us in a way that nothing else can.
Yeah, and you know, what's so profound about what you just said, Marcia, I'm literally born in like 1960s. I don't have any memory of the 60s. Mm-hmm. What I can tell you is by the time I got to high school and I was taking, you know, social studies or what we call history class, depending where you were in the country, they always stopped the social studies or history classes at the end of World War II. We never got the civil rights movement at all. And I'm the generation that benefited from the civil rights movement. And so to your point, when I got to college and I started taking, we called it at Rutgers in New Jersey, New Brunswick, New Jersey, Africana studies, my mind was blown. I was like, wait a minute, we were not just enslaved people. We actually, civilization started in Africa. Is that right? You know, it was mind blowing for me. And I read everything I could get my hands on. You know, how did I become a writer at Rutgers? Two of my 4 years in school, I worked at the library, the Alexander Library, and they could never find me because I was always in the E-185 section, which is where all the Black books were. So I'm there reading Angela Davis, George Jackson, Malcolm X. You know, I'm discovering Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer. I'm discovering the poetry of Baraka and Sanchez, like I said, and Nikki Giovanni and Audre Lorde and Maya Angelou. I mean, it was incredible. And, you know, two things came out of college for me. I was like, I'm going to be an activist. I'm going to help my community. And I'm going to be a writer. I was like, I didn't know how I was going to do it. I'm a poor kid from Jersey City, New Jersey, single mom. But I said, I'm going to figure out a way to merge Malcolm X with James Baldwin and Langston Hughes. I'm going to put it all together. That's what I was determined to do. I'm 18, 19 years old thinking like this, but I was so blown away by them, you know, and I don't know where my love of theater began. Well, actually I do. It began when I began to hear about this man, August Wilson, and also studying the Black arts movement, realizing that there was a whole Black theater movement, as you know better than I do, that was happening in places like Philadelphia and Harlem and other parts of the country. And so somewhere in my study of African-American studies, as I'm learning the history and the music and the poetry and other things, I began to hear names like Ed Bullins and Lorraine Hansberry. And so it all kind of came together. And what it helped me do as a writer, as a young person at the time, was that, you know, oh, I actually come from a rich culture, a rich tradition that I can be a part of. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
I also wanted to ask you about your life as a poet, because this is leading into your 15th book.
Yeah.
I find that absolutely amazing.
Thank you. That's hard.
Your 15th book, and it's called Grocery Shopping with My Mother. It is a collection of poems, and you say that you have not done a collection of poems in
14 years.
So tell us how grocery shopping with my mother came to be, and why did you wait so long?
Well, you know, it's interesting you asked that question. 2008, we were trying to get rid of George W. Bush out of the White House. 2008 is the year that Barack Obama and Michelle Obama won the White House. So we all were caught up in that. And also, if you remember being a Brooklynite like I am, in 2008 and 2010, I ran for Congress in Brooklyn. So my life went from the arts to politics. And it's funny now, I look at pictures, I'm like, there I am in a button-up shirt, an Oxford shirt with some khaki pants, looking like a politician. I'm an artist, Marcy. I'm an artist. I'm like you. I like colors. I like flowing clothes. I like, you know what I'm saying? But I got caught up a few years in that. And then I just went back on the road doing speeches and things like that. And I don't even know what else I was doing at between 2008. I got, you know, I got married, I got divorced. If you don't know that, I did. I'm saying a lot of stuff happened in my life. And I just fell away from the poetry. But my mother, between 2015, 2020, you know, got sick. And I had to start helping her grocery shopping. Because there was times that she couldn't even hold the fruits and vegetables that she loved. I'd have to grab it for her. And I spent many days over a couple of years going with her to the grocery store every couple of weeks, checking in on her. And I literally would be walking behind her sometimes and just crying because I'm an only child. You know, my mother is the only person who's been a constant in my entire life. And I just I was grappling with the fact that I was now in that place. And you know what I'm talking about, where you slowly start to become the parent to your child, the caretaker. And I just started posting things to social media as a way to try to express myself. I wasn't thinking about no book. I wasn't thinking about no title for no book. I wasn't thinking that I have something here. I was just like, man, you know, I don't know what to do with this. I just want to post it to Instagram or Facebook. And what was striking, people were responding to it. You know, people were saying, that's my father. That's my mother. You know, I really love your stories about your mother. And and I'm trying not to get emotional thinking about it, but it was just, you know what art is, Marcia. It's healing. You know, even if we just write some stuff down, it's just for us. But somewhere in all of that, and I went through a lot of craziness between 2015, 2020. Like I said, I got married, I got divorced, my mother got sick. I became, you know, our roles have switched. You know, my mother started saying things to me like, you act like you, I'm going to be here forever. I mean, it's hard to hear that stuff. You know what I mean? I'm trying to process all of it. And it slowly started to make its way into poems. Plus, we also dealt with the madness of Donald Trump, as you know, during that time. You know, and Breonna Taylor was killed, and George Floyd was killed, and all these other Black folks, women and men, Sandra Bland, all these folks were killed. And so I'm digesting all of this. And as much as I love writing blogs, or what we used to call essays, you know, shout out to James Baldwin again, I realized that I really, really, truly missed the economy of being able to get a poem out of me, you know, quickly. And that's how it started. And then once I started, it just kind of spilled out. And I realized that I missed being a poet. And keep it for your audience, when I moved to New York, literally 1990, I dove right into the New Rican Poets Cafe scene. And so I came up with Ras Baraka, Mary and Mina Sun, and Asha Bandeli, and Willie Perdomo, Tony Medina, Paul Beatty. It was a lot of us who came, Jessica Care Moore. There's a lot of us who came through that scene. But I'm one of the ones who stopped writing poetry for a long time. There were people who didn't even know that I was a poet. That's how long it's been. And so I'm excited about this poetry book because it's dedicated, obviously, you know, it's inspired by my mom, but it's also something that I needed to do because it's like art is liberating and I needed poetry. I missed it. You know, journalism, you know me as a journalist. A lot of people do. I don't consider journalism necessarily art the way I consider poetry is just different, you know, and it's something that I didn't realize I needed and had missed so much until I started writing it. When I put this book together, and I'm excited about it. And it's been exciting to get responses already from people. And I'm just joyful about it. Yeah.
And I'm going to put you on the spot.
Yeah.
Right. Please. Here. Would you like to do a selection from the book?
Yeah, I can. Something, let me think what I can, you know,
something
what?
Short.
Yeah, actually I have an excerpt of something I was reading this morning, and tell you how excited I am. I'm holding the book in my hand. It's just coming out this week, but I was up late last night. I haven't read the book. You know, the way book publishing works, for a lot of folks may not know, you might write the book a year ahead of time and then it finally comes out a year later. And you're like, relieved, man, this book is finally out. But this poem I'm going to read is called I Am Magic. It was actually written for a sister friend of mine, a great sister friend of mine named Bridget Moore, who is an amazing choreographer and dancer out of Dallas, Texas. I'll just read the last part of it, if I can get to that. Because the poem is dedicated to Black women, and I'll just pick it up here. There, that, art, dance, learning, Black girl magic, be like Cicely Tyson, Sarah Vaughan, Ella Fitzgerald, Lorraine Hansberry, Angela Davis, be making a way out of no way, be Black women and Black girls strutting through the sky, even when our wings are barely taped together, because ain't no love, no families, no communities, no possibilities, no church, no Holy Ghost, no get out the votes if we ain't here, because we are magic. We can do anything. We can moonwalk our bare feet on fire and taste sunrise when others cannot taste at all. That's because the thing is, for me, Marcia, like the poem is, there's two long poems for my mother, the first in the book and the last in the book. But it, as it turns out, there's a lot of poems in the book just about Black women in general. There's a poem called Our Mothers. There's a poem about Cicely Tyson. Because I love y'all deeply and I appreciate y'all deeply. And I know that if there's no Black women, there's no me.
Grocery shopping with my mother. How do we get the book?
Everywhere. It's online. I would suggest supporting independent bookstores. You know, you got Sisters Bookstore up in Harlem, New York City. You can order from. There's Malik Bookstore, another Black-owned bookstore on the West Coast. There's Greenlight Bookstore here in Brooklyn. There's other, you know, this. I would suggest seek out your local independent bookstores wherever you are listening to this show, wherever you're based at. That's what I would encourage. Please support independent bookstores, especially Black-owned, women-owned bookstores. I would encourage that. Yeah.
And what would you say to people who have lost their way, lost their passion? What suggestion would you give to them about getting back to their core, their heart? What will heal them? What is healing you?
Well, you know, that's a great question. If I can just be brutally honest, because that's all I know, 2 years ago, if you'd have told me that I'd be sitting here at my 15th book, I don't even know if I thought I was going to be alive 2 years ago. 2020, the year started with Kobe Bryant dying tragically with his daughter and seven other people, as you recall, in that plane crash. A lot of us, especially Black men, were deeply affected by that. I actually was at his memorial a month later in February of 2020. Little did I know, in March of 2020, COVID would hit. It literally wiped out my living, because people think that writers make money. No, we artists, you know, Marcia, we hustle.
We don't.
It's a hustle. And my main hustle, which is public speaking for 25 years, was wiped out instantly. All my speaking engagements were gone because of COVID, because we couldn't go anywhere. And then I was going through a divorce, and I ended up having to declare bankruptcy for the second time in my life. And by the time we got to the fall, September, one of my dear friends, committed suicide. Another artist blew his brains out. Black man. You know what I mean? I had hit rock bottom in a way that I couldn't even explain. It is harder when you're older. When you're older, you know, I'm like, you know, I don't call it middle age. I just says I'm in the middle of my time on the planet. That's what I'm going to call it, Marcia. But you know what I'm saying. But I was able to deal with it when I was in my 20s and 30s. But when you get to your 40s and 50s or older, it was devastating for me. And, you know, what do I say to people? You can't give up. And I had to draw on the strength of the God and goddesses that I believe in. I had to draw on the strength of our ancestors. I had to think about what my mother had survived, and her mother, and my grandfather, and all the way back, and how we survived the Middle Passage, and how we were kidnapped from Africa. I called on everything I could, because I was just like, I can't give up. And I kept thinking about, you know, when my friend called me and told me that his son, who I'm also friends with, had committed suicide. I was outside in a public space doing a documentary for a German crew about COVID. You know, they were talking with folks from different parts of the world. I literally fell to the ground in tears, Marcia. I collapsed. You know what I mean? And because I felt the anguish. And the last time I had talked to this brother, and the film is actually dedicated to Tariq, so I can say his name. The last time we talked, that was September 2020, a month before, we had exchanged text messages when Chadwick Boseman had died of cancer, you know, and he was devastated by it. He didn't know that I knew Chadwick. I knew Chadwick from way back. I saw Chadwick's whole journey. None of us knew that Chadwick had cancer, and it hit a lot of us hard. And I just, you know, there's been a lot of loss, you know, and I think that I had to say to myself, you know, you were put here for a reason, no matter who you are, Marcia Pendleton, Kevin Powell, whoever's listening out there, you know, you're here for a divine purpose, and you just cannot give up on life. You know, you can't control how long you're going to be here, but what you can control is what you do while you're here. And that's what got me through it.
Thank you so very much, my friend, Kevin Powell.
Thank you.
And I want to encourage everyone to find a copy, go buy a copy, and buy more than one and share it with someone. Grocery Shopping with My Mother, a collection of poems by Kevin Powell. Thank you for being on. This is Backstage Stories on listener-supported WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and streaming at WBAI.org. I'm Marcia Pendleton, your host, and we just listened to Never Given Up by the great Al Jarreau. And speaking of Never Given Up, let's learn how Jacinto Taras Riddick pushed through to tell a very important story the way he needed to tell it. Here is my conversation with Jacinto. And we are now speaking with actor, screenwriter, producer, director, Jacinto Taras Riddick. We happen to know each other, and I know his work as an actor. I don't know why, but I always see you in roles where you're playing the bad guy.
Yes. Yes, that's what I'm known for.
Where you're playing the bad guy, but you would recognize him from his many guest starring appearances on television shows such as The Blacklist, Blue Bloods, Law and Order, Elementary, and many, many more. I can say that I turned him on to his Broadway gig. Yes. In A Streetcar Named Desire with Blair Underwood and Nicole Ari Parker. But tonight he is with us in his capacity as a screenwriter, producer, and director, but also acting in a film that you'll be able to see as part of the African Diaspora International Film Festival. It's called A Brother's Whisper. We'll talk a little bit about that and how you can see it. But first, let me just say welcome, Jacinto.
Thank you so much. I am so humbled that you asked me to come on this program with such a dynamic presence and a spirit and just an energy on the theater scene. And I'm not going to let you just sweep by that. I saw you on the train. Marcia, I'm getting choked up talking about it. Mm. I'm hearing that Streetcar Named Desire is coming to Broadway. I've been telling my agents about this and there's been no movement. Do you know anything about it? And you said, let me see what I can do. And you reached out to Stephen, and Aaliyah. And the next thing you know, I got that audition. So it's about those connections and this is rattling because that was such a powerful thing. You know, we always hear about the connections, who you know. But it's also who you know and then presenting that talent to that person and having to have the talent to back that up. So you arrange that meeting. And I just, out of respect for you, I did my best in that room and I booked that job. And
yes, you did.
That connection. Thank you so much for that channel.
You're quite welcome. You're quite welcome. See what can happen when you ride the subway.
Yeah.
Some good things can happen when you ride the subway. So let's talk a little bit about your background. How did you become an artist? What inspired you to become an artist? Who inspired you to become an artist?
I started with God first. Mm-hmm. Then God created my father and mother, two dynamic spirits, two dramatic spirits. My father focused on theater most, and I was raised in his program called Ndota Intercultural Arts Center. His name is E. Preston Riddick, prominent figure in the Clinton Hill Fort Greene Best community. Mm-hmm. And there we were raised in theater, martial arts, drama, percussion, and voice. And I just really immersed myself into that. And then I went to, did all of his plays in the community theater with the Alonzo Players Theater. His co-founder was Cecil Alonzo. They met in Norfolk State, came up to New York, started one of the first Black theaters in Brooklyn. I started performing a lot of, plays with them. And I went to Brooklyn College after that, and the rest was history. I got my agent coming out of college. And the next thing you know, I was going on professional productions. And the only thing that separates professional productions from community theater during the time I was going, because community theater had excellent acting, passionate theater. It wasn't just bad acting. It was very, very passionate theater, talented individuals. But what separates is getting paid.
Yes.
More. Community theater, you literally only got pay for no rehearsals and you got paid for the weekend. And I'm talking about something like $20 or $25 a performance. So you a big paycheck in community theater was $150 for the week. That was a big paycheck, $175. And but my first Broadway, I mean, my first professional gig in theater at Baltimore Center Stage was $700 a week. I almost fell out. I almost fell out. Plus insurance, health insurance.
Wow, so, that's a lot. What was the play?
It was called Mary McClinton's. You know Mary McClinton, Police Boys.
Okay.
Boys, powerful, powerful play. It ended up coming up to New York. I originated the production at Center Stage in Brooklyn. Very powerful police community harassing the inner city of Baltimore. And things are just set off. Had a very spiritual, powerful element to Yoruba, all the tradition, everything that was in that play. It's all that spiritual, cultural power that meets the urban streets against the corrupt police officers. So, yeah.
I wanted to ask you, what makes you say yes to doing a project? We all know that we all have to eat, we all have to pay the rent and, you know, keep the lights on and keep the heat going and all of that kind of stuff. But beyond that survival mode, why do you say yes to a project?
I start off with really good writing. I try to look if I'm literally, I've been a person that once I read a script and if it's good writing and I could see the characters really develop and they're going somewhere with it, my ears perk up, my spirit perks up, my heart gets involved into it. You mentioned that I play a lot of bad characters, and unfortunately, in the Black and brown community, the reality is, I don't care if you go to Yale, Juilliard, NYU, it's going to be whether or not you can tap into that inner city hood, because it's pretty much the establishment, you know, coming to get you and what kind of handcuffs you're going to be put in. That's the reality of the situation. Now, you can see all these characters. You can say, okay, how I'm going to work if I'm not going to play the gangster, the drug dealer, how am I going to work? So then how I looked at the drug dealer and the gangster, did he have vulnerability? Did he have layers to it? Can you do something with it where you can, illustrate the humanity in him? And I was able to tap into it. So I said no to a lot of the excessive N-words, the grabbing of the genitalia, ones that were just one-dimensional. I said yes to the ones that were the smartest in the room. And what it ended up doing was the public became on my side. So when I walked down the street, you told them, man, we're glorifying it. But they saw a person of color up against the establishment and being the smartest in the room. And they saw that if this person had been given a chance, he could have been a Wall Street broker.
CEO, yeah.
500 company, mm-hmm. or head of a powerful organization to really uplift his people and finance it in a way where it could be very profitable and successful. So they saw that. So they embraced me. So I turned it on them. That's what I did. I turned it on the edge and said, okay, I'm going to do this. Watch me be the most interested in the room. No, but they're not going to, you know, that's me feeling like if this is what I'm going to have to do, I'm gonna approach it this way.
And it's true. The characters that I've seen you play, even though they've been mostly bad guys, they have been multidimensional. There have been layers. You could see their vulnerability, and you did understand that they were human beings. They were not just these monsters, these thugs, you know. And you were the smartest person in the room. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Scary, but smart. Let's talk a little bit about your role as a storyteller in this film that is going to be the closing, that is going to close the African Diaspora International Film Festival. It's called A Brother's Whisper. You are the screenwriter, the producer, director, and you also act in it. What was the genesis of the story? Where did the story come from? And tell us about the story and where did it come from? Why did you decide to tell this particular story?
Well, you know, that wonderful segue that we talked about me playing certain type of roles actually feeds into this. Mm-hmm. There's so much more. There's so much more to people of color than what they're presenting on television. It's getting a little better now. Mm-hmm. As good as you think it is, only 12% of all characters that are in film and in television are African-American. It's even less for Hispanics, Asians, like 3%. It's looking good, but that's still the numbers, the last I checked. We're so much more than the Dominican drug dealer, what I play a lot, or the Puerto Rican drug dealer, or the inner city hood brother. And I said, if I wanted to tell a story, let's open it up. So let's give it that full dimension of all the things that we can talk about. And I'm not going to approach filmmaking or storytelling until I have something to say. So one of these stories that just came to me, I mean, it just came to me. I wrote two or three screenplays before, and that whole thing about, you know, trying to pitch inquiry letter agents or trying to get investors to invest in that. It's no joke just to even get a few hundred bucks. So I said, let me try to get a short film going. But then it morphed into a medium-sized film feature. And it's called The Brother's Whisper. So let me give you a sense of what that is. Solomon Bordeaux returns home to Brooklyn after serving three tours of the Iraq-Afghanistan wars. Diagnosed with PTSD, he faces the harsh realities of racist gentrification in a neighborhood he no longer recognizes. With the welcoming by his brother David, a rising pro fighter, familiar bonds are forged, but soon interrupted by the disturbing secrets that unfold. And so when I saw the racist gentrification of Clinton Hill, I was born in Virginia, raised in Clinton Hill, Fort Greene, Clinton Hill co-op, say where apartment buildings then. And so by the time I was 3 years old, raised in the co-ops. And to see the mass displacement of Black people in Clinton Hill, Fort Greene is a travesty and tragic to me. It was like that Native American used to have that one single solitary teardrop falling down his eye back in when we were growing up. You know, when he saw change, when he literally was walking through the wood and he stepped his foot on that pavement and he said, change is coming. The world is about to be polluted. And so seeing Blacks disenfranchised and marginalized out the neighborhoods of Clinton Hill, Fort Greene, Bed-Stuy, Harlem, spoke to me. Sexuality within the Clinton Hill, Fort Greene, and people of color, how do we receive sexuality? How sexuality perceived? How do we operate? What are the taboos? What are the things that are said, okay, this is normal? And then the stories of knowing that Black people have fought in every war on American soil and still not getting their due justice. We still have the wealth gap. We still have the prison industrial complex. We have targeting of Black men, putting all those Black men in jail for marijuana, building the jail system, three-strike laws. And I decided to say, well, what kind of trauma did these guys come home from Vietnam, World War II, World War I, the Korean War, and not having a job, not having a place in society, still brothers fighting in Vietnam and still being shot down by police, not even respected. And so all of that come to that post-traumatic stress syndrome. And I said, let me build this story together. And then the last of that, I'm a fighter and I've been a martial artist all my life and a boxer. Let's use boxing as a metaphor. When you're down, you still come up, throwing combinations. I'm still here. And that's how we brought everything together to create A Brother's Whisper.
So you put the budget together. How long did it take you to film the project and put your actors together? And I'd like to find out who is in your cast.
Well, so we got the money together. Like I said, it just came in little segments. And then I started right away. the crew, going to get the DP is first. That's one of the first things, finding that DP. So the answer is trying to find a DP with its own camera. That'll save you on the rental houses. And we found a wonderful DP in the name of Jeffrey Akers that had the red camera that was supplied to him by his good friend, Vagamond Beaumont. And the cast started with my dear friend, Louis Laporte. He was the first one cast as David, who plays my younger brother. And his stage name, again, is Che Ayinde. A wonderful, wonderful stage actor. Does a lot of Shakespeare. Beautiful, beautiful artist. We moved over to a sister named Lakeithia Dalco, who's just doing her thing. I mean, she's got so many projects. She was voted into the Sundance Lab, and I think 2018 or 19. And now she's writing for a wonderful television show. She's in a lot of just rooms, just being that just artist in a room writing for these different television shows. Her name is Lakeithia Dalco. Then we have another wonderful actor that I did Jitney with in Denver and Arizona, Phoenix and Tucson at the Arizona State Theater Company and Kansas City rep. His name is James T. Alfred. He plays Gabriel, and he tears it up. I mean, he's one of the audience's favorite, and that as well as everybody, David, Lakeithia, her beauty, David's beautiful artistry brings the house down. Lakeithia's beauty caught in between Solomon, her husband David, and Solomon, the brother-in-law. She sits as that nucleus that tries to hold them together, and she's just caught up in the middle, and her pain that she has to endure, phenomenal. So it came about a year, and then the first day of filming, Marcia, was a cold, cold day in 2018. You heard that year? 2018. Mm-hmm. And my lead actor, Che Ayinde, on the first scene, popped his calf. Running up the stairs, he plays a boxer, and he has to be fine-tuned, or a specimen of physicality. And you'll see in his body, the women swoon over it. But he popped his calf. I had to wait 5 to 6 months for his calf to heal. So we had to pick up later in 2018. And then completing it, and then going into post, and then COVID, and then having to shut down for these 2 years and grabbing little pickup shots where we can. And it brings us all the way to 2022, where the Pan-African Film Festival picked us up, and we won the coveted, prestigious Janet Dubois Award for Excellence in Filmmaking. So that journey from 2018, the completion post to COVID shutting us down for 2 years, moving apartments to different apartments, culminated in a wonderful award at the Pan-African Film Festival in April of 2022.
So now you're going to be the closing film for the African Diaspora International Film Festival on Sunday, December 11th.
Yes.
At 6:30 p.m. at the Cowan Center Teachers College at Columbia University. How did you arrive at this particular festival?
Well, Diarra Indoor Speck, who is the co-founder of the African Diaspora International Film Festival, and her husband, Reynaldo Barroso Speck, if you remember, it's the film Sankofa.
Right.
Originally part of that powerful film Sankofa was a part of that film festival. They started in 1992. And I saw that film and I wept in the audience with our kids that we take with the Adota Entry Program, me and my father. I had to turn my head. So all these years later, they reached out to me because of my the award win at the Pan-African Film Festival and said, we would like to see your film, to see if it can be a part of our festival. So we sent them a private link. They called right away and said, we want your film to be either our opening night or our closing night film. We want to get behind this film. And so she thought it best to be closing night in New York City. We were talking about France, Paris, Chicago, the tour of the African Diaspora International Film Festival, where it goes all over. But she felt it best to close in our hometown, New York City. So that's where we're going to be on December the 11th, 6:30 p.m., Teachers College, Columbia University. I hope all of you come out to see that film, this film.
And you can get information about this film and others at the African Diaspora International Film Festival by going to nyadiff.org. That's nyadiff.org. Thank you so very much,
Hasan. Let me just say, Marcia, go to that festival. A lot of people get a little tricky in the navigation. Go to the festival, and on that first thing, you scroll down, and you see that film poster, A Brother's Whisper. And you got to click on that poster.
Click on the poster.
And then it'll send you to the direct purchase website. And visit the other wonderful films that they have here. But specifically, we're talking about A Brother's Whisper. That's how you do it. Or you can go to my film, our website. The name of my production company is called ColoredSectionFilms.com. And that says it all. Colored Section Films. When we were marginalized and disenfranchised, we had to depend on ourselves to create and to build wealth. And so hence the name Colored Section. When we were marginalized to a certain corner, we were able to create.
One more thing. Is there access to you through social media?
Yes. I'm at ColoredSectionFilms.com on Facebook. I am on Instagram as well. I think it's College Section Films on Instagram. Social media is my lady's handle, all those things. I'm so embarrassed to say. I don't even know my Instagram, but you'll find it, Colored Section Films, ColoredSectionFilms.com. Has to be specifically in that name, ColoredSectionFilms.com. So we are on Facebook and Twitter. I'm at Jacinto Taras Riddick. You can find me on Facebook, Jacinto Taras Riddick. You can find me on Facebook and my personal page. But with ColoredSectionFilms.com, our website, you can get all the information and you can receive a discount if you go there.
I want to thank you for being a part of the program this evening, and we'll see you on Sunday.
Thank you so much, Marcia. Thank you so much for having me.
All right.
Truly appreciate you.
This has been Backstage Stories on listener-supported WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming at WBAI.org. I'm Marcia Pendleton, your host, and I want to thank Kevin Powell and Jacinto Taras Riddick for taking the time to speak with us. Please support these artists. Pick up a copy of Kevin's 15th publication, Grocery Shopping with My Mother. Get it online or at your favorite independent bookstore. Connect with Kevin at kevinpowell.net and get your ticket to see A Brother's Whisper, written, produced, directed by, and starring Jacinto Taras Riddick at the African Diaspora International Film Festival. To connect with Jacinto, visit his website at coloredsectionfilms.com. And I want to thank you so very much for listening. Please join us next week on Thursday at 9 p.m. for the next Backstage Stories. We are going to leave you with Love Yourself, music with a message and a serious hook from artist and activist Tony, Grammy, and Emmy Award winner Billy Porter. Have a good one.
Always remember who you are. unstoppable. Self-love is the solution. Be a part of this revolution.
I said I like it like that.
I said I like it like that.
I said I like it like that.
On Monday, December 12th at 6:30 p.m., Juan Gonzalez gives a talk, Latinos, Race, and Empire, at the CUNY Graduate Center at 365 Fifth Avenue at 34th Street in Manhattan. As he prepares to move to Chicago, Juan Gonzalez shares what he's learned about democratic rights, racism, police abuse, and imperial control during more than 50 years as radical activist, acclaimed journalist, and historian of the Latinx experience. This farewell talk by Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now! And former New York Daily News columnist, extracts lessons from his time in the Young Lords, the Puerto Rican counterpart of the Black Panther Party, and beyond. Latinos, Race, and Empire, a talk by Juan Gonzalez at the CUNY Graduate Center, 365 Fifth Avenue at 34th Street in Manhattan. Attend in person or online. The event is free. And for more information, go to www.gc.cuny.edu. That's Juan Gonzalez on Latinos, Race, and Empire, this Monday, December 12th at 6:30 p.m. See you there.
New York, it's me, Jimmy Dore, and I'm back on New York's alternative radio station, WBAI. Tune in to the Jimmy Dore Show every Thursday night at midnight into Friday morning on WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM in New York and streaming online worldwide at WBAI.org.
Max Politics is moving to Friday. This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette and the host of Max Politics here on WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Our show is moving from Wednesdays to Fridays at 5 p.m., so check me out then with guests including elected officials, advocates, candidates for office, experts on a wide variety of policy and political issues, and more. We're going in-depth with newsmakers, analysts, and other great guests every Friday starting in August at 5 p.m. here on WBAI.
Hi, this is Doug Wood from Green Street, heard every Tuesday morning here on WBAI. At most radio stations, the focus is on advertising, ratings, and profits. Here at WBAI, the focus is on people and issues. We don't have advertisers, and while that provides us with editorial freedom, it also means we depend on your financial support to stay on the air. Please join Pat.